Hi, I'm Brian Pearson. This is The Mystic Cave.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. And our modern boat was one as we sailed into the mystic. Hark now, hear
the Mystic Cave is a sanctuary for the seeker. Stories, conversations, and reflections about the spiritual journey on the other side of Churchland. I continue reading from Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland, my memoir about loving the church, but in the end, leaving it. This is Chapter 9, Part 1. In this episode, having survived my plunge into the deep end of parish ministry, I was ready to expand my horizons. If I could make it in a congregation, just think what I could accomplish in a diocese. But moving to the Diocese of Niagara, I was exhausted and badly in need of a rest. I also needed to pay long overdue attention to my young growing family. Fortunately, Church of the Redeemer in Stony Creek gave me that opportunity. Once again, as in Cookstown, the church was ministering to me.
And together we will flow as we sail into the mystic.
Everything about Stony Creek just felt wrong. It clung to the eastern edge of the city of Hamilton like an afterthought, despite being an historic town in its own right, where the British had once given a decisive whooping to the American forces in the War of 1812. But the town had met its match in modern-day suburban sprawl and eventually in annexation. Its defeat was reflected in the tired storefronts that hadn't changed since the 1950s, and in the sad sign at the Optimists Park that read, "Just Say No." Lake Ontario was north. In every place I'd ever lived, the water was south. Burrard Inlet, the St. Lawrence River, Lake Ontario itself when I lived in Toronto. Here, Hamilton Mountain, so-called, was south. But mountains in my life had always been north. The North Shore in Vancouver, the Laurentians in Montreal, even the rolling farmland around Unionville that rose northward from Lake Ontario. The city itself was wrong, too. No one moved from Toronto to Hamilton. For one thing, they feared getting the snot beat out of them at a CFL game between the Tiger Cats and the Argonauts at Iverwind Stadium. Hamilton was a blue-collar steel town, proud, boastful even, of its lunch-pail roots. Wear a jaunty yellow bow tie to a summer social, as I once did, and you were going to feel like an alien, like someone from, well, Toronto. It didn't help that the bishop who lured me there, John Bothwell, was himself directionally challenged. We met up at a restaurant prior to my interview with the search committee for the Church of the Redeemer in Stony Creek. He wanted to meet me and offer some impressions about the parish for which I was applying. I think he also wanted to woo me, as he had done a good number of my classmates from Trinity. If this worked out, I would be joining some of my favorite people from my divinity school days. There couldn't have been a less imposing man. Round and puckish, with small twinkling eyes, John Bothwell, or Jack to his friends, was in truth fiercely intelligent, funny, and progressive down to his bones. He had ordained the first women priests in the Anglican Church of Canada and was a mentor to many young liberal-minded clergy. That's why so many of my Trinity classmates had gone to the Diocese of Niagara to work with Jack. I didn't know if bishops in different dioceses talked to one another about their clergy, or if it was just something in the wind. But once I knew my days at St. Philip's in Unionville were numbered, I received a call from Bishop Bothwell. He had a parish I might be interested in. Talk about timing. Over warmed-up pasta at a sad and empty pizza parlor, Bishop Bothwell gave me his pitch about Redeemer, said some nice things from what he'd heard about me, and reviewed the many reasons he thought I'd be happy at Redeemer and in the Diocese of Niagara. I'd agreed to the interview with no commitment beyond that, but I felt he was reeling me in. We left the restaurant in separate cars. I was to follow him to the church, where he would make the introductions and then leave. He swung his car out onto the road. I followed, but something seemed off. I could see traffic bearing down on us from up ahead, in all lanes. I don't know if he saw it too, but the street he wanted was just a block away, so he drove the full distance and then made his turn. Right on his bumper, I waved apologetically to the oncoming cars as I rounded the corner behind him. Church of the Redeemer was modest but attractive. It was set low to the ground, anchored by several concrete buttresses, like the exposed roots of some massive tree trunk. The church appeared even smaller than it was because of the towering Niagara escarpment, which rose up immediately to the south. Renovations in the 1960s had included the addition of a nice little chapel with narrow windows of thick stained glass where the morning sun would cast the small altar and the ring of wicker chairs in luminous blue and gold. There was a generous church hall attached to the north side of the building with a full floor beneath for meeting rooms and offices. It was all there. The only disconcerting feature was the rectory, a tall red brick Victorian house located right on the property, filling in the crook of the capital letter L between the church and the hall. Its backyard was overseen by the windows of the parish hall, and its lawn was shared with the church. Also, the rectory needed work. A recent fire in the kitchen had damaged the upstairs bathroom. The floor tiles in the front hall were all lifting. These were all fixable, but also a red flag. Sandy and I hoped we would never have to live in a church-owned rectory again. The experience had not been a happy one in Unionville. St. Philip's sold off its rectory while we were still living there, a large and beautiful country house on a quarter acre of land, rather than commit to its repairs and upkeep. It was replaced by a slapdash modern house on a suburban street where the snow gathered in little drifts in the front hall during winter. When we asked for storm doors for the sake of our babies, rectory maintenance was weighed against the church's staffing expenditures, which made it hard to justify. But the search committee at Redeemer was warm and welcoming. They were proud of their solid little church and hopeful for its future. They had progressive ideas about liturgical innovation and community outreach, and they wanted a priest who would help take them there. After the interview, they wanted me to be that priest. I could be him, I thought, but I kept it to myself for a few days while I considered the strange new world I'd be coming to. The Niagara Diocese felt more human-sized than the Toronto Diocese had ever felt. It was more small-town high school than big-city collegiate, with less than 100 clergy on its rolls. In Toronto, with its 250 clergy, only a chosen few were ever called to serve on diocesan committees, and those who were had better make a good showing, or they'd be returning to the boonies, never to be heard from again. My maiden performance on the Building and Property Committee, calling out the committee's decision to fund the building project of my own parish, had pretty much done me in right there. It might have been years before anyone asked me again. But there were opportunities aplenty in Niagara. It had committees and working groups and task forces for everything, and policies and guidelines for all human conditions, from youth ministry to career development to sexual harassment in the workplace. Its program life was so extensive, they employed a full-time diocesan program coordinator. They even had their own church camp and conference center. I was still angry at Bishop Price. I was upset about having to leave Unionville, feeling that I'd been given no other option. I hadn't failed at my job, yet somehow I felt like I had. I knew I would be burning bridges as I went. Archbishop Garnsworthy once said to me that leaving the Diocese of Toronto was a lot easier than coming back. I now took that to be prescient. But John Bothwell was everything I could have asked for in a bishop, and his diocese embodied a version of the church I might have fashioned for myself. The Church of the Redeemer seemed stable and progressive. Sandy didn't like her nursing job in Toronto anyway, and Heather and Robbie were not yet school-aged. It might just give us a new lease, not only on my ministry, but also on our home life. One thing life had taught me growing up, sometimes it's better to move than to change. Perhaps Bishop Bothwell knew it, or perhaps it was just fortuitous for him that the six people who interviewed me for the Church of the Redeemer may have been the only forward-thinking members of that congregation. Everyone else seemed pretty content with things just the way they were, from the traditional worship on Sundays to the strawberry social in June. No one was too interested in the projects and the possibilities I came up with. Betty, the church secretary, had to be coaxed to produce a simple monthly newsletter saying it wasn't necessary. Everyone already knew what was going on. A short while after I arrived, we began to study some possibilities for renovating the church to allow for a more creative and flexible use of its worship space. We had a model made up by an architect, a design favored by the building committee, a group made up of me and the Progressive Six. We displayed the model prominently in the hallway between the church and the parish hall for people to inspect. We hoped they would catch the vision. But the parish had little appetite for a building project, let alone a capital campaign to support it, so the model gathered dust until one day it was quietly removed. That was okay with me. I had almost burned myself out at St. Philip's. If Redeemer offered me a chance to catch my breath while extending my reach into a new diocese, I would take that as a gift. I didn't yet see this as a pattern. Work to the max, take a break. Work to the max, take a break. Many years later, at my retirement banquet from St. Stephen's in Calgary, amidst speeches and presentations, one of the church wardens made an observation about my career path. "Let's see," she said. "2 years in Cookstown, 6 in Unionville, 3 in Stoney Creek, 6 in Oakville, 2 in Tofino, and 20 years in Calgary. Let's just be thankful we caught him on the upswing." Bishop Bothwell lost no time plugging me into the machinery of my new diocese. Whatever his hopes might have been for the Church of the Redeemer, my new parish, it was clear that what he really wanted was to put me in service to the diocese. This was a good thing, because the waters closed quickly behind us when we moved from Toronto. People in Western Canada chafe at what they see as the maddening elitism of Central Canada, and Toronto in particular, which seems to assume it's the center of the universe. What Westerners don't realize is that West for Toronto actually starts at Mississauga. Stoney Creek is a half hour's drive west of there, along the Queen Elizabeth Highway. When we moved away, we were dropped from the Christmas card lists of many of our Toronto friends. We might just as well have gone all the way to Alberta. Within a year of my arrival, I accepted Bishop Bothwell's appointment to the team of chaplains to ordinands. We nurtured relationships with divinity students who were streamed for ordination, as Colin Proudman had done for me as my examining chaplain. Then I was asked to lead the training program for those newly ordained, like Toronto's potty training, except that Niagara had its own acronym for everything, so this group was called NOG, for New Ordinands Group. From there, I was invited to play a leadership role in the worship of the diocese. This meant planning the worship for the annual meetings of synod. These gatherings of clergy and lay people from across the diocese were opportunities not only to attend to the usual business of budgets and elections, but also to inspire the delegates with new ideas to take home to their parishes. I worked with a committee that identified a theme for the meeting, chose appropriate readings and hymns, and then produced a unique graphic design to carry that theme forward, appearing on the worship booklet, special banners, and sometimes on the altar cloth itself. I was asked in this capacity to help plan the liturgy for the consecration of Walter Asbel, the new coadjutor bishop who would succeed Bishop Bothwell upon his retirement. I was to provide color commentary for a telecast being made of that service. This placed me at a table in the tiny sacristy just off the sanctuary of the cathedral, seated before a video screen waiting for the service to begin. Suddenly, the visiting bishops from other dioceses across the country burst through on their way to the back of the cathedral to join in the opening procession. Bishop Price was among them. He saw me sitting there with headphones on in front of a microphone and a screen and gave me a little smile, but it was more a smirk, as if to say, "Figures." Bishop Bothwell had even greater ambitions for me in Niagara and beyond. He took me and another priest with him as his aides to a conference for Anglican bishops from across North America. It was held at a remote retreat center in Asheville, North Carolina, requiring us to change aircraft at Atlanta and fly the rest of the way in a small turboprop. It wasn't clear why the two of us priests were there, to us or to some of the other bishops, who resented the presence of underlings. But it was an extraordinary privilege to learn alongside them about changes and challenges facing the church, and even to witness their anxious hand-wringing about the stresses of their job. As he drove me home from the airport, Bishop Bothwell picked up ice cream cones for my kids along the way. At the door, as they gathered around my knees, he turned to me and said, "These aren't the days of your greatest creativity." I didn't know exactly what he meant, but it felt significant. It would become something to bring out and ponder from time to time as I traveled further down this road. A miraculous thing happened in the absence of bone-crushing day-to-day, late-into-the-night church work. I began to be a dad, and I began to play. Heather started school in kindergarten, right across the street from the rectory. She liked imagination, and she liked magic. With no close girlfriends her own age, she invented one of her own, Katie Sarah. When there was something Heather didn't like, bedtime for instance, she would wave her invisible magic wand and, in her words, prince it away. "It's bedtime, Heather. I prince you away." Robbie, at 3 years old, was a frog in the nursery school play, put on in the church hall. He ribbited and bounced around like an exercise ball. This was good, because he had hardly said a word for his first 2 years. When he did speak, it was in complete sentences, but also with a lisp and a Bostonian R, like me at his age. So for a while, he was Wobby Peelthin, until girls began to take an interest in him. Then he went silent again, recalibrating his pronunciation. So ribbiting was good. He was still working on it. I built them a two-story playhouse in the backyard of the rectory. I used pressure-treated beams and clapboard siding and a simple design, which was all I was capable of. But it had a ladder inside and a roof on top and plenty of room for imaginative play. Members of the congregation would offer words of encouragement, or perhaps a joke, from the windows of the parish hall as they looked down upon me, glistening and shirtless, hammer in hand. Then Benjamin came along. He arrived in the usual way, but very unlike Heather and Robbie, both of whom had made us wait. So when Sandy felt all the telltale signs, we were not in a rush. We arranged for friends to come over to watch the other two. We called ahead, and then we made our way across the Burlington Skyway to Joseph Brandt Hospital. We were just settling in for a long night when we received a surprise. Ben was ready and impatient to get the show on the road. He came so fast that the doctor had to be called for. He strode in, took one look at me, and said, "I think Dad needs to sit down." He was right. All the blood had drained from my head, and I was about to become the one requiring medical attention. For summer vacations, we discovered the church camp at Big Bay Point, up on Lake Simcoe. If you were a clergy person, you could buy a cottage there for a grossly deflated price, which made it affordable. But you had to sell it the same way, there being no market value other than that set by the camp itself. We rented a cottage from others who owned there for a week or two at a time. We swam, we sailed, we watched as the kids played at the beach or out in the field. When Sandy and I needed a night out, there was always a neighboring cottager to babysit, allowing us to go into Barrie for dinner or to the drive-in theater for a movie. We maintained friendships with people we met in Unionville and began making new friends in Stony Creek. We spent every New Year's Eve with Dave and Judy Simpson, who, like us, were a young family of five. They would come to us from Stouffville, or we would go to them to stay overnight and usher the new year in together. On those memorable nights, the kids would run wild about the house, their faces flushed, while the adults drank wine and played music and traded stories. Dinner might go on all evening, culminating at the midnight hour with the parading of the haggis around the house for those on both sides with Scottish blood, to ear-splitting recorded bagpipe music. I would then address the haggis, Robbie Burns style, having written an ode that looked back over the year, more or less trashing it. I began playing music again. My friend Tim Elliott, a fellow priest and an accomplished pianist, pulled a band together after he had auctioned himself off at a fundraiser for his parish. He thought it would be more fun than playing alone, so we played the gig with him at a local pub. The guests from a Polish wedding reception one floor above us decided that we sounded more fun than their DJ, so they joined us. That inspired the name we gave the band that evening, Polish Wedding Reception. After that, we became known simply as The Preachers, because following a few lineup changes, the band ended up comprising five clergy. We became a bit of a hit, playing on Saturday nights at fundraising chicken dinners and church halls. Max Wolliver, our frontman, sometimes left the stage mid-song to gather up the dinner rolls from people's tables and juggle them high in the air as he moved through the audience. When people appreciated our music and our antics, plus the fact that we were all clergy, Max used to say to them, "I know, people say we're wasted on Sunday mornings, but actually, we're just a little tired." At a clergy conference late in the spring of 1991, 3 years after I had arrived at Redeemer, Bishop Asbel, who had just succeeded John Bothwell, called me aside to have a word. He wanted me to consider a move to St. Simon's in Oakville. I think he saw that I was biding my time at Redeemer. St. Simon's would require more of me. I went home with my head spinning. I had not been anticipating a move. It was hard to focus as interviews were arranged and as Sandy and I considered the logistics of a move at the end of the summer. Other things were demanding our attention at the same time. During the past year, my mother had been battered by a series of debilitating strokes. She'd been given a clean bill of health just prior to her 65th birthday. Her doctor said she had the constitution of a teenager, but then she suffered the first stroke and then another. She was diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor. Suddenly, my mom was dying. We began making frequent day trips to visit my mom and dad at their home north of Grand Bend. When she was hospitalized in London, I would sometimes do the 3-hour round trip alone, driving through the darkness at the end of the day. I recall the silence of the car and the depth of my sadness being like that night in Unionville when I'd sat up with Fred as he lay dying. Those drives were strangely nourishing in the way of a deep soulfulness. There was no lightness here, but there was love, and there was gratitude for the closeness that comes when all else is falling away. With each successive stroke, my mother lost a little more of herself, her mobility, her speech, her memory. Finally, with the interventions of chemotherapy and radiation, she lost her hair. "We always thought your dad would go first," she said to me late one night, with remarkable clarity. The soft lighting in the room made it feel like a confessional booth. She smiled. I wondered how she did it, to just accept it like that. She wasn't angry or frightened, just resigned. To everything else going on that summer, we tried to add a family vacation. Sandy wanted to get back to Calgary to see her own parents. We packed up the family and flew out, but no sooner had we stepped off the plane when I got the call. I turned around and flew back. I drove from the airport straight to the hospital. The others, my father, my brother, and sister, had already been and gone. I sat stroking my mother's hand. She was unresponsive, slipping away. It was hard for me to let go. She died in the night after I left. And when that foghorn blows, I want to hear it. I don't want to fear it. And this has been Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland. Thank you for sharing this story with me. Please leave a comment or share a story of your own on the Facebook group The Mystic Cave, or get in touch with me personally at mysticcaveman53@gmail.com. In part two of this chapter, I jump again, but right back into the fire. Would I never learn? The church provided me with all the work I could ever do, but the care of my own soul would be up to me. A good lesson the Trinity had tried to teach me. If only I could learn it this time. Join me at St. Simon's in Oakville. I'm Brian Pearson. This has been The Mystic Cave. It's too late to stop now.